bachelor's at the University of Manitoba. So Chris was heavily involved with the Red Team's activities over the past few years, and he brought a lot of that great experience with him to lead Tartan Racing to victory this year. So it's my big pleasure to welcome Chris Ernst.
Wow. And that's my talk for today. Thank you. So I guess I'd like to start. This is becoming common practice for everyone on Tartan Racing. Before I get going, can everyone on Tartan Racing stand up who was part of this? That means you too, Mike and Mike. So any one of these guys. Any one of these guys and the numerous others who aren't in the room today could be given a seminar today about something incredibly exciting and interesting. And unfortunately, you have to listen to me talk for the next hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. What I'd like to do is tell you a little bit about Boss, a little bit about the team, and how we did it. I've got about an hour to go through it, so I'm going to try and give a little bit of technical detail, but I can't go into eye-watering detail on anything, fortunately for you. But over the next year, I imagine many of our teammates will be giving talks about how the parts of the system they worked on behaved. This is a little just snapshot of some of the stuff you'll see today. Boss driving down roads. This is the kind of internal model that Boss has of the world. So the blue lines are the roads the Boss knows about. The blue stuff are curbs. The red things are obstacles. The propellers are places Boss is trying to get to. In this case, it's this parking spot. And then these multicolored rectangles are things that Boss has identified as vehicles. You see in the parking in action. And I think this is Boss coming back from the end of a mission. And you'll see off to the left almost certainly a crowd of red jackets standing up and cheering. A word of warning. Most of the talks that I give have a picture that looks like this, or perhaps this in it. This year, the worst we had was this, where we had two cars bumping. So those of you who came for the crashes today, unfortunately, are going to be a little bit disappointed. So the Grand Challenge, this is where it started a few years ago. At the time, before the 2004 Grand Challenge, the prevailing mentality was, this just couldn't be done. We weren't ready to drive long distances autonomously, even across in a static environment. We just didn't believe that it was possible. Well, it didn't happen the first year. They were proof right then. But by the second time, we were actually able to get four vehicles as a community, four vehicles across the finish line. These vehicles were driving at high speeds, in some cases up to 50 miles per hour. Our vehicle was doing about 35 miles per hour peak in the desert. It was a really interesting, challenging problem, but as you'll see today, much, much easier than what we tried to take on with the Urban Challenge. Basically, the vehicle was given a ribbon that it had to stay within, a set of paths that we'd like it to drive on, and then it had to not hit things in that environment. And that was it. It was very exciting. It could do it at high speeds, could do it with sexy video with helicopters and dust clouds. But compared to what we did this time, much less so. So the Urban Challenge. In this case, what we were trying to do is develop a vehicle that was able to drive in urban traffic. It had to, and in practice, it ended up being more like suburban traffic. If we took a Boss and put it in downtown Tokyo, it probably would generate a lot of gestures and maybe not be the best place for it. The vehicle had to be able to interact with other traffic. It had to be able to merge between vehicles. It had to be able to park. It had to stay on its side of the road, which is pretty important. We didn't have to do that in the previous challenge. We only had to travel up to 30 miles per hour, which at first blush doesn't sound that fast, but I actually spent some time looking at my speedometers as I toured around Pittsburgh, getting from my house to the university and whatnot, and I found that most of the time I wasn't actually braking 30 miles per hour, and it was pretty questionable that I was doing that. Obviously, if I'm on Boulevard of the Allies or the freeway, then that's a different thing. But in suburban driving, it's not really needed. In contrast to the previous challenge, the Grand Challenge, the Urban Challenge was a multimodal problem. The way we kind of broke it down was that there was road driving, there was intersection handling, and then there was parking. And if you look at just that first piece of it, road driving. It sounds a lot like the Grand Challenge, except now you have to deal with traffic conventions and being on the right-hand side of the road. You have to deal with moving obstacles and other vehicles that are potentially doing stupid things. And so just that problem is much more difficult than the whole Grand Challenge from the previous year. So when we talk about the problem in a very loose sense, we think it's maybe an order of magnitude more difficult than what came before it. Once again, you know, there was some nice motivation from the government, at least, about $2 million for the team that came first. And this time they got it right, where they put some money up for second and third place. That was one of the, among the disappointments from the last race, is that we had two vehicles finish it and come second and third, and we got an attaboy, and that was about it. A little bit of truth in advertising before I get into the meat of this. There's a lot of stuff that's out of scope. When you look at these vehicles driving around, you can perceive or infer a lot more capability than's really there. No doubt we have a capable vehicle, but there's a lot of things it can't do. It can't deal with traffic lights. It can't deal with traffic signs. Pedestrians were out of scope. Bicycles and motorbikes were out of scope in our case. We believe we deal with pedestrians and bicycles in a reasonable way, but it's not principled and it's not really what we intended. We don't have to drive faster than 30 miles per hour. Again, we believe we could push that speed up a little bit with some of the sensing and the control that we have, but we haven't tested it. We didn't have to do coordinated driving, which would have been very exciting, but some pit crew stuff and moving on blocking all that on the race course, but that was out of scope. And cross-country driving, kind of the classic UPI-type problem where you need to maneuver through vegetation and off-roads, was not something we concerned ourselves with. So on to the real motivation. The prize money is nice, the glory is nice, but you need to have more than that, I think, to actually invest as much as our team did in this project. One of the biggest things is safety. If you look at the statistics for North America, and this was news to me, traffic accidents are one of the top causes of death for people our age, well, for most people in the room. Traffic accidents. Sorry, Matt. whoa. That's probably my laptop. Traffic accidents are the number one cause of death. If this were a disease, then NIH would be putting money into it, just like crazy. It's an epidemic. And it's not just deaths. There are millions of people in this is just U.S. statistics. This isn't world statistics that are injured. And if you just look at it from a strictly financial point of view, the insurance payout, the lost days of work, there's a huge motivation. And then there's, of course, all the societal and personal issues that are to do with that. So if we can get this technology from, boss and the classroom and the lab to vehicles that are driving on the street, we could actually have a real, measurable impact. Beyond that, there's this motivation for industrial work. We've done a lot of robotics that deal with static environments. Dealing with moving obstacles around the vehicle and doing it safely is kind of a cornerstone or a keystone technology. As soon as we can make the vehicle safe around other people and other vehicles, then we can actually take these things out and deploy them in a meaningful way. And Caterpillar and Co. are interested in it. When you look at beyond that, some societal benefits. The elderly, as we get older, we lose the ability to drive safely, and that privilege is often revoked. And these are some of the people in our society that have the biggest, most amount of wisdom, the most amount of experience. And that's a part of our society we don't really want to lose. The truth is, though, that in North America, it's a driving society. And so if you lose the privilege of driving, then you're stuck in a home. You're stuck somewhere where you can't get out and mix with people. And that's a big loss. If you want to turn it around to just a fiscal statement, there's studies that the car makers have made that have performed that say that basically there's a point where you don't drive anymore. You don't buy a new car. From the automaker's perspective, if they can push that back from, say, age 62 to age 72, that's two new cars, in that person's lifetime they're going to buy. So beyond the kind of the heartstrings, there's also, again, a financial benefit to it. Giving people back their personal time. So instead of the two-hour commute into work or the hour commute in the morning, they can be doing email or sleeping or whatever, playing with their kids. So they could get in the car and they could not waste that time driving when they don't have to. And then, of course, our friends at the Defense Department would like to get soldiers out of harm's way, and that's obviously a good thing. So there's lots of motivation for the work we're doing it, beyond just rah-rah, we want to race. So people, we had a lot of them, and we had a lot of great people. When we started the program, this is the first meeting we had. These are the folks that showed up. By site visit, the team looked more like this. And by race day, it was practically an army. For anyone who was out there, we had, you know, 50, 100, 200 people. So it was very exciting. Similarly, the team, from a corporate point of view, began with a commitment between Carnegie Mellon and General Motors to compete in this. And then over time, we were able to bring in old friends from Caterpillar, from Aplanix, from Intel, and then bring in some new friends like Continental and some of the other sponsors here that worked with us to really make this success. And I say sponsors, but that's not really the right term for it. These were partners. Many of these partners actually had people who were contributing day to day on the project. It wasn't just a, here's a bag of money, we throw it over the fence. It really was an integration. That was one of the very exciting parts about this project, is we were able to take our kind of academic know-how and push it directly to industry people and have them work with us and learn from them and then learn from us. So organization, the team, we really kind of saw the technical problem breaking down like this, where perception is seeing the world and modeling it. Mission planning is figuring out, obviously, how we get around, given a roadmap of where we want to go, how do we get between the different points in that roadmap. Behaviors is making the tactical decisions at an intersection. Whose turn is it? When do I really need to be in the right lane or the left lane right now? That kind of that kind of decision making. Motion planning is keeping the vehicle safe and executing what the tactical layer tells it to do. Vehicle controls is pretty self-explanatory. This is enough to get the technical part of the team working, but actually, to be successful in an endeavor like this, it takes much more. We have to deal with all our sponsors and our partners and make sure that they're getting what they want out of the project as well. The system engineering and test, which is something we often overlook in the academic community, but this is how we get a vehicle that is technically interesting and make it competent, capable to go out and work any given day. We had an advisory council of some of the brilliant people around campus who we could ping on a need-to-need basis and, you know, how would you solve this problem and get some insights, then go back to work. And then the steering committee was part of the structure that we had with General Motors because of how big a partner they were with us. So a little bit about BOSS. So BOSS is a 2007 Chevy Tahoe. It's basically stock. It doesn't have nuclear power or solar generators or anything. That was one of the big questions we got. It did, you know, was how is it environmentally friendly? Well, it uses flex fuel. But, you know, that was not really our focus, obviously. We were interested in the autonomy. We set the vehicle up to be not only a race car, but also a test vehicle. So when we designed it, we pushed to make sure we had all four seats in the vehicle, and this was a real big advantage for us. We have one guy up front who's the safety operator, and their sole responsibility is keeping that vehicle and everybody else who's testing around them safe. And from my opening slide, where the biggest damage we had was a 2 mile per hour bump between our car and another, that kind of process worked. The second seat up at the front, the passenger side, is where we had our lead software operator, and they're the person who's kind of making sure everything's turning over, booting the system, and, you know, advising the driver what's going on. It's kind of like, if any of you watch Rally Car, there's a guy on the passenger who's reading out, you know, turn coming up, 30 mile per hour, slow down, giving the feedback, or feed forward perhaps, to the driver of what's going on. In this case, we have the person reading the telemetry back from the robot and saying, okay, everything's good, we see that car, this is safe, and then, no, kill it. something untoward just happened. And, you know, they can be monitoring real time what's going on with the vehicle. And then the back seats are perhaps the most, you know, the biggest benefit. That's where we can have the developers get in the vehicle and say, you know, and see what really happened, and have the perception guy point at the planning guy and the planning guy point back at the perception guy. One of the stories I use at other places, and I'll share it here because Dave's here, is, you know, Dave is, for those of you who don't know him, is, you know, brilliant, but also very competitive. And one of the battles we had day to day was, Dave wants the vehicle to go as fast as humanly possible. Well, no, as fast as robotically possible. And, you know, I want it to go fast, but I'd like it to keep all four wheels on the ground. And so, you know, I'd go out and test something, or somebody else would go out and test something, and, you know, Dave, David's a little hot in the corner. And David, oh no, I looked at it in simulation, it's wonderful. And then we get Dave out in the robot. Oh, that is a little hot. So, you know, it allowed us to keep people grounded, and there's an awful lot we can do with simulation and data playback, and it's very important. We couldn't have done this program without it. But without being able to get our developers in the vehicle and have a vehicle that was up and running all the time, we just wouldn't have been successful. So I'm now going to turn to perception and tell you just a little bit about that. Oh, look at that. This is going to suck. So perception. There's BOSS, and it's really the perception system is responsible for three things. The first is figuring out where BOSS is with relation to the roadmap that it knows about. So ahead of time, we're given from DARPA a connectivity map that says, you know, this road connects to this road, and here's some rough geometry. We then offline go in and fill in extra information that describes the shape of that road. And when BOSS is driving around, it's trying to localize itself using GPS and lane markings to that road. And so then it can, you know, figure out where there's a stop line coming up and where it needs to turn. The second part is detecting the things in the world that don't move. So cones, walls, trees, that kind of thing. And then the third is figuring out where the other vehicles are. Remember, the scope of the problem this year was vehicles only, no pedestrians. So anything that's moving is a vehicle in our minds. So how do we do that? Well, we had a lot of sensors. And then we had some really great algorithms on top of that. So on the vehicle, we had something like 19 different sensors. We used 15 of them actively. Sorry. We had 27 sensors. We gathered data from 19 of them all the time, and we used 15 of them. Some really neat things on here, the continental radars and continental LIDARs. These are what they call ACC, or Advanced Cruise Control, or Adaptive Cruise Control sensors. They put them in the front of your high-end automobile. You get on the freeway, and you tell it to do 70 miles per hour. And if that guy in front of you is doing 55, then it'll slow down nicely behind them. If there's nobody in front, then it'll keep speed. So it's intended for highway driving. We have some short-range proximity radars from MACOM. These are like 15-meter range or 20-meter range. And they just kind of give you there's something there. Some long-range sensors. These are LIDARs from Ibeo. They're very much like the SICK lasers, except instead of having a 0.8-degree beam, vertical beam width, they've got something like a 3.2-degree vertical beam width. And they give you four different elevations, so you can do some smart things with that, conceivably. High dynamic range camera. We spent a lot of time looking at lane mark detection using the camera. We ended up determining that for this race that it wasn't the right solution, but we did some really, really neat research there. And then kind of the magical sensor we have on the vehicle is up at the top right, this Velodyne. It's a really neat story behind this. In the Grand Challenges, there was a team from Velodyne, which is a speaker-making company, that the first year they decided they'd use stereo vision and for robot driving, and well, that didn't work so well for them. And then they said the right answer is clearly to make a laser. So they came back the second year with this monstrosity on the top of the car that had 64 lasers spinning around. It kind of looked like a little helicopter. They ended up turning it into this product, which we're using. I think some of the UPI guys are using. I'm not sure who else. But it's a 64-beam laser. It measures out to about 120 meters. We used it to about 50. 30 or 26-degree vertical beam width, 360 degrees. Really good situational awareness sensor. And then we had pose estimation from GPS and INS. So how did we use the different sensors? We used some of the lasers and the camera to some degree in road detection. For obstacle detection, we used only laser sensors. So this is detecting static things in the world. And then when we go to vehicle tracking, we used a combination of laser and radar sensors. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the vehicle tracking system. I don't really have time to get into either of the other parts, but I'd be happy to answer questions about them later. The thing I forgot to mention at the beginning is if you have any questions, please just let me know. I'm much more interesting when someone else is talking. So that would be great if you could interject as we get into this here.
I missed one thing.
Matt.
What are you using to pick up the lane markings?
Right now we're using downlinking lasers. We did do some work with cameras, but we settled on the laser solution. So this is a typical snapshot from the vehicle. This is data from during the race. And what you're looking at here is first, this is BOSS down here, the little icon. The squares and diamonds are returns from the radars that we have on the vehicle. And you can see we kind of get a fruit salad. And then we have these dots are data from the laser sensors. The first step in our vehicle tracking system is to do feature extraction. And we use a combination of the work that Marshall's group and Christoph and co have been doing with Datmo to do process the SICK data and some work that we did to segment the other lasers on the vehicle to extract corners. So these L's are things that we think could be potential vehicles out in the world. We then do some measurement validation. So one of the problems you have with radars and with single plane lasers is it's hard to disambiguate, in the radar case, something with a large radar cross section, like perhaps a pop can, from something with a large radar cross section, like perhaps a car. So we want to make sure that there's physical extent to those obstacles. The other is that with a single plane laser, you can get a cut across something out in the world, like a gentle slope or a cut across the rear bumper of a car, and you can't readily distinguish between them. So what we did is we looked at that massive laser we had on top of the car to look for physical extent and vertical extent. And so that's where we get these instantaneous obstacle maps. These are these red pixels out here. And we say, well, if there's a car there, then almost certainly we're going to have some physical extent to it, both in the X and Z directions. So we'll call those things valid. The other thing we said is, well, this is a race, and the cars are going to be on the road in general. If someone has a car-shaped thing in their front yard, it's probably a bush or a sculpture. And so we'll throw out edges that are far enough from the roads that we don't think they could be a vehicle. We'll still consider them obstacles, but we won't consider them potentially moving obstacles. Once we have the measurements that we're interested in, we do data association between those current measurements and what we've seen in the past. And so what you're seeing here, these kind of outer gray boxes are the bounds over which we'd search for associations, and then the more rectangular boxes are places where we had previously got a measurement. The sensor then takes those takes the measurements and generates proposals, and it's really hard to see. But these very faint boxes are proposals that the sensor has generated about where the vehicle might be in this instantaneous frame. And what you can't really see up at the top there is that that sensor has proposed there's one obstacle that sticks up that you can see, and one that's perpendicular to it, because it doesn't know which way that car might be oriented. That corner doesn't really give you enough information. And unfortunately, you can't really see that up there. Once we have got those proposals, we do data association. One of the neat things about the system we developed here, the algorithm we developed here, is that we have two different models for what might be moving in the world. One is kind of the canonical car, which we call a 2x5 meter rectangle, or approximately. The other is, in cases where we don't have enough information to say what the orientation of the car is, we'll just consider that a point obstacle out in the world. And so what you can see here is we fit cars to these things, the big rectangles, and there's one object out there that we don't have enough information to say what orientation it is or how big it is. And so we just say there's something there, and that's that point obstacle. And then the last step is to do motion prediction. So we use a multi-hypothesis model-based approach for this. So we take a vehicle, like this car here that you saw in the previous frame, and we say, where could that car be going in the future? And we look at our road model and we say, well, it's going to probably continue driving down the road. And then when it gets to an intersection, it could either go around the corner or it could go straight. If there's a stop line, it might slow down for the stop line and wait. And so we get this kind of shadow that's floating out of this tail. It's the different places in the future where we expect that car to be. And when we go to motion planning in a minute, we consider where our trajectories will be out in the future to see whether they'll collide with those predictions.
Chris, do you use the previous information to, and the fact that you know that it's a car, to help you in orientation? I mean, except in, really bad weather, you're not going to see both sides.
Right. We do to some degree. So I'll show a slide later that shows that I'm not strictly correct in this, but the answer is yes. We try and use the orientation from the previous, and we see if it's reasonable. But each sensor kind of votes on it, and at some point, the sensors can say, no, I got that wrong. Because it could be, when we get data from a car 100 meters out or 50 meters out, that our first estimate of the orientation of that car was incorrect. So we do need to have some freedom. And Mike, if you want to jump in and tell me where I'm messing this up. Michael Darms of Continental was the guy who developed this.
Well, basically, yeah, there's a history of your every sensor says its opinion how it thinks the vehicle is orientated. And then you have a couple of sensors having opinions on that, and then you have a voting scheme which selects the best proposal how the vehicle is oriented.
So it sounds like the answer is no, you're not actually using previous range.
We're not?
I thought
the previous orientation of the vehicle had some weight in the orientation.
Of course. So there's only one sensor which says, hey, I have new orientation, and you have a long history of having the correct orientation, but it's supported by many sensors, you don't switch at once. So then you use that information, say, I reject that false positive from that sensor, and that's kind of.
Okay.
Do you try to recognize vehicles like, you know, oh, that's Cornell, they're flaky, you know?
No, we don't. We did put some effort into determining whether something was a vehicle or not, and got some reasonable results, but not sufficient that we thought it was of benefit. The kind of the way BOSS disambiguates, you know, thing on the road from vehicle on the road is basically time. If it doesn't move for some amount of time, it says, well, it's either a dead vehicle or it's something that's never going to move, so I'm going to pretend it's something that's never going to move. Okay, so I'm now going to turn to talking about the mission planning and the behavioral system for a little bit here. I told you up front that kind of the part of the way that we specify where we want BOSS to go is it's given a map. And then on that map, it's kind of like going to Google. You say, I want to get to this location, and then it figures a route through that. So here's an example that DARPA gave us early on of somewhere in, I think, Virginia. If we take a zoom into this corner here, so we have some connectivity from these roads and some crude geometry. And then there's a four-way stop up there, and it's got the four little octagons around it to indicate that. What we do is we look at the connectivity of the space, and we generate a graph to search over, and the numbers here are the cost to get to checkpoint four, which here is the goal. And then we basically treat this as a value function so that should we get a blockage as we're driving around here, say we detect that there is a tree cutting the road off here, we can then instantly recompute an alternative route there. We had that sounds really simple when I say it in one sentence like that, but the kind of what's under the hood in tracking the state of what's blocked in the road and what's not is actually pretty complicated. Unfortunately, I don't really have time to get into it today. But Matt McNaughton did a lot of that work and would be, I'm sure, thrilled to tell you about it at some point. So, intersection handling. This is one of the big parts of behaviors, and so I just want to give you an idea how we did this. So we have some cartoon of an intersection over here, and it has four stop lines. And so there's a part of the intersection where if there's a vehicle, we don't want to be in there because that's just kind of poor form. These are robotic vehicles, and they might do something unexpected, and if we're trapped in there with them, they might take us out. On top of that, DARPA said we really shouldn't be in there when they're in there. Then around the intersection, we basically set up little polygons where if there's a vehicle, we're going to track to see, you know, who got there first, effectively. And so if we're coming from the right and there's a vehicle already waiting in that polygon from the bottom, then we'd say they have precedence over us. And then there's some hysteresis and other, you know, complicating stuff around that. That works really well if there's a four-way intersection. Well, what happens if we drop down so there's this traffic coming from the left and right is controlled by a stop line, but the stuff going through can just continue on like on the main road. Well, we basically take the same idea and extend it a little bit. We maintain the precedence polygons for either side here, but we add what we call yield polygons to the north and south here, and we look at basically time to collision down through that yield polygon for anything that's moving, and we give that precedence over our guy waiting at the intersection. So the video here shows BOSS on the test course we have here in Pittsburgh, just demonstrating some very simple intersection precedence. One of the things that we found through this project is it's hard to get decent video of a robot well behaving in urban driving because it's kind of boring. You know, it goes out there and it stops at the stop line, and then it goes, and it doesn't get too close to things, and it just behaves normally. So we did our best, and I hope you bear with us for the video today. So I showed a little bit about the yielding. This was one of the tests that they did at the National Qualification Event, which was the gateway to getting into the race. This is BOSS on what was a figure eight track, with 11 vehicles swirling around it. So the bus is coming up to the stop line. At this point, it's recognized that there isn't anything blocking its route. It has enough room to pull out, so it gets in here. It's cut in front of these other vehicles, but with enough space. It's going to track around the outside loop here, and then it's going to come up to make a merge across traffic in the other direction. This was, in my estimation, the most difficult test they put the vehicles through at the qualification event. The course was fairly small. I think it was about 200 meters long, and to have 11 vehicles swirling around it. A human driver could certainly do it, but it's a non-trivial task. And the boss saw the two vehicles go by, was tracking both of them, and decides to pull out and safely complete that. One of the things, part of the behavioral system is determining when it's safe to pass. So in this case, boss came up behind the slow-moving blue car in the center lane, realized that it was going slowly, pulled out to pass, and then had to get back into the left lane afterwards to make the turn onto the gravel road here. In making the decision to pull into the right lane to pass that vehicle, boss is assessing how far it is to the next turn that it has to make in the left lane and determining that it has enough time to safely pull out and pass that vehicle and then get onto this dirt road and start back off into DARPAville here. Now, I want to show you some of the foibles as well as the quality driving. So one of the things we didn't put a whole lot of effort into is really kind of making the passing behavior perfect. So in this case, boss is pulled out behind, I believe this is the Cornell vehicle. And the Cornell vehicle is driving slowly. So boss says, OK, I can pull out past him on the left. And the Cornell vehicle moves over. So boss gets over here. He says, oh, crud, I'm almost out of lane. So it comes back in this lane. And then, maybe over here. No, that's not the right place. Should probably get back over. And this is kind of the classic example of the local minima problem, but illustrated nicely with this. So we did not really do any kind of detailed global planning with the passing engine. So anyway, so this was one of the more comic moments during the challenge. One of the last things, and perhaps overall most important things about the behavioral system is that its ability to recover from failures. One of the things that we hammered home through the course of this was that the vehicle should never stop moving. It was kind of a hard message. But the idea is that the vehicle is going to be it's going to make mistakes. We're roboticists. Everyone's worked with robots here. Has anyone had a robot that actually worked perfectly? Right. So what we needed to do is we need to design our system so that when it screws up, it can still do something. And so that's the whole notion here with the failure recovery system. We wanted to keep it as simple as possible because obviously if we add a whole lot of complexity in our error recovery system, then it's probably not going to work. So is Chris Baker here? So Chris and John were the architects of our behavioral system. And I apologize to anyone if I haven't said that your work, so we don't have any publications yet. I can't put the little reference down at the bottom of the slides here. But I don't want to give the impression that I did all of this. We had a gigantic team of great people. And I'm just happy to be the one lucky enough up here to tell you about it. But this is John Dolan and Chris Baker's work. Anyway, back to the story. So the idea is normally boss is going along and it's moving through its behavioral logic and making decisions. At some point, it either realizes that it hasn't made enough progress over time, and so at that point it kicks into an error recovery mode, or something like the planning subsystem says, the road's blocked, I don't know what to do now, and then that kicks us into an error recovery mode. In the error recovery mode, behavioral system tries to do whatever situational dependent thing it can. So it'll try to walk down the lane and find different goals to get to, or try to pull a U-turn, or whatever else. And the engine is designed in a way that it generates an infinite number of possible actions until it gets something that worked. And we saw this kick in on race day. Instead of just giving up, it basically shimmied around enough that something broke loose and off it went. So I'm now going to move on to motion planning. I'm going to get it right out front here. Dave Ferguson, Tom Howard, and Max Likachev were the guys who were responsible for this work. The heart of our motion planning system is Tom's trajectory generation algorithms. The idea is that we generate a set of trajectories that roll that are rolled out along the path in front of us, and we pick the one that does the least damage to the vehicle and keeps it as most centered in the lane as possible. And there's actually a whole lot of magic to the cost function it's minimizing to line itself up on corners. And Dave would be much better suited to tell you about that, and I think given a seminar at some point next semester. So anyway, that's basically whatever we're doing, whether we're driving in a parking lot or we're driving down the road, we're rolling out these trajectories in front of the vehicle, seeing what collides and what doesn't, and then picking the one that has the best cost value. So on-road driving is pretty straightforward. You stay in your lane and there's a limited search. When we move to parking, here's just another example of Boss driving along the road here. You can see it's staying within its lane. It gets pretty close to the center line, and that's probably a little bit of a controls issue. But it does a nice job, and then you can see it, the behavioral system here slowing us down so we keep safe distance behind the vehicle in front of us instead of cruising along at 25 miles per hour.
Chris?
Yep? Yes.
So
yes. Okay. So the lane planner works really well on lanes, but we also had to solve a parking lot problem, and we also had to have something that would get us out of trouble when just following the lane doesn't work. And so what Dave and Max came up with was this a variant of the Anytime D-Star algorithm that works in parking lots and wherever else. It's basically a 4D search. It's looking at the position of the robot, its orientation, and then a very skinny dimension for direction of travel. Let me just rewind for a moment here. One of the things you can see, if I go back to the beginning of this video. As we come into here is, we can generate the plans ahead of time offline, so given whatever information we have. And then as we get close, the planner is churning over and it's refining the plan. So this is kind of the anytime part of D-Star kicking in here. We get a much smoother path. We do the nice little swirl into the parking lot because the cost function we set up basically says that that's more efficient than driving backwards and jimmying around. John? So we're going to that very specific spot where the multicolored set of rectangles were here. That's specified by DARPA. They say you have to get to that particular spot. If we'd like to generalize this to be really useful, we'd like it to go hunt and find the easy spot, or perhaps the spot closest to the door, something like that.
So were there cars in other spots?
There were cars in other spots. So in the opening video, I showed it parking between a couple of vehicles, and in the next slide, I'm going to show, the last point I just wanted to make here is that we have two of these guys running. So we have one planner running, computing the current problem, and another planner computing the problem immediately after that. So we can always kind of go. There's always a plan ready to run, so Boss can be kind of efficient and quick. One of the things you will see if you've watched video of the other teams is they kind of get to the parking lot and sit and then go. In our case, we get to the parking lot and go, which was a time advantage, and it's probably what you'd really like a vehicle to do. So if we look at parking, this was a test that was conceived by Bob Bittner, who's our evil test lead. So this is the problem Boss was given. So this is a parking lot. The blue outline is where Boss is trying to get to, and it's or where Boss is allowed to move within. And then up here, where the mouse is actually the spot I think it's trying to get to. It's mislabeled in the diagram. And then what you may be able to see is a faint set of dots that kind of swirl around like this, and these gates up here. Now, Boss doesn't know about these ahead of time. It's detecting them in real time as it's driving in. These are just here so you can understand what the problem is. And if this starts moving again. So Boss is going to come in, and this was a point in the program where we didn't have the two planners running simultaneously, I believe. So you're going to see a little jerk at the beginning here where it stops and thinks. Now it's coming in and it's going to have detected the cones, which you can't really see. You'll just see as the blur as it starts to drive here in a moment. This was it thinking. This is why we have the two planners, because the problem is computationally complex enough that it can't turn over instantaneously like the trajectory generation stuff can. So it's going to swirl around through these parking spot or these parking markers, pull out and around. It's a real joy to ride on when it's doing this too. And then it'll find its way through the gate over here with just enough room. It didn't hit anything there, it just came close. The opening was not significantly wider than the vehicle, so it had no choice but to come close and gets to its parking spot. The last thing I want to talk about from the tech point of view is the infrastructure. This is something that's often overlooked in talks, but it's really an important part of making the system work. We looked around at what was available to build complex systems, and we don't know everything that everybody in the room is using, but we weren't able to find something we were happy with. So we took a lot of the ideas from the systems we developed with Red Team, but had been developed, you know, with some of the infrastructure from, you know, back before C++ was really C++, and looked at what was available in the way of publicly available libraries like Boost and Base++, and took that and put it into what we think is a great package for software development. The goals of this were for it to be light enough weight that people could pick it up pretty quickly and run with it, that we could really do reuse, that we could have a very efficient message passing system, and that we could support the idea of testing it, playing back data, replaying, and then running simulation all with the same software. So what we came up with was, this is the front end to it, and we call it Trux, which is the Tartan Racing OCS. What we have here is a 3D display over here that's completely pluggable. So as a developer, you have some data you want to display that's coming over our pathways. We can throw that up there. You can render a little 3D widget that'll render your data into this window pretty magically in, you know, not many lines of code. Over on the right here, we have a pluggable tab that you can basically add anyone. So I think this is our position tab, but Dave can add stuff for planning, Mike can add stuff for perception, whatever we want to display up there, and again, do that in a very small amount of code. So you can basically have a look inside the system, what's going on in real time, with a very easy and extensible interface here. We can do all kinds of data logging, we can synchronize all the data streams, play them back, and use that for analysis. The last thing I'm going to talk about before getting into the race here is how we did system engineering and test on this project. So one of the things that we knew going into that was that the scope of this project was large enough that we couldn't kind of just throw everything at the wall and hope that we came out with a vehicle that would drive at the end. So we looked up front and we developed the requirements that the vehicle had to meet, and we broke those down by subsystem. We ended up with a list of 400 different things, I think, that the vehicle had to be able to do. And they're, you know, in eye-watering detail. If you can squint close enough, vehicle shift actuation shall be capable of moving vehicle between drive and reverse in less than 10 seconds, you know, and other things of that kind of resolution. And then we didn't just do that up front as an exercise. We actually kept that document alive and lived with it through the program. I've seen many projects where you kind of think, oh, this is a great idea up front, and then let it fall by the wayside. We were very diligent in maintaining this, and we ended up, by the end of the race, we either tested, verified, or just said, you know, we were wrong in our thinking, and we're going to cancel that requirement, every item in that list by race day, which was pretty exciting to me. We tracked progress every week, so we forced the team to do system testing once a week, every week, and at first there was a little bit of resistance to that. But I think by the end of it, people started to see that actually there's some benefit to regressive testing. Everyone in this room is brilliant, and everyone in this room can develop great algorithms. The problem is you need to be able to go out and see what happens when you put that brilliant thought to paper, because that's where the error is going to come in. When you actually implement the code, there's some subtle bug in it, and we need to find out what that subtle bug is. And then maybe there's also something slightly flawed with your reasoning, so we need to go out and test that as well. We also had a system to track defects, so things in the system we considered done, like the car. We figured the car should probably drive. Well, if anything on the vehicle, on the car broke, we'd say, well, that's actually a fault, and that's not good. So we're going to take that part that broke, and we're going to figure out, A, how to fix it, and then B, why did it break? You know, maybe it was because we put some odd, you know, load on the bus, and that was putting the voltage over or under. Maybe it was a thermal problem, so we need to add cooling. And so we'd go into a lot of effort in finding out what the root cause of these problems are and go fix it systematically so that it didn't happen again. And that's how we were able to take a vehicle out and race it. And over the 2 weeks that we were out at California for the test, never really touched the vehicle. We just kind of parked it and let people look at it, which was very exciting. The last is that We used a kind of a graded software development system where at the beginning we let people just kind of do what they wanted and, you know, work towards this common goal but do their creative thing. And then we started to get a little more focused, a little more controlled in how software was committed and what the process was. And by the end, you had to have submitted a bug to actually to make a change to our software system. You had to say, this is exactly the problem I'm fixing and why. And then it had to be approved, and then we committed that. And it was actually a pretty neat system. And it ended up getting us a system that worked pretty darn well. To give you an idea of how much activity was going on, between September 1st and November 3rd, we closed 533 bugs, which was pretty exciting. One of the things that kind of made it fun, you know, this process stuff sounds pretty dry, but it was important and actually kind of fun. We got this little, Chris Baker had this little buzzer that you hit it, and it played the Imperial March from Star Wars. So we had a process, part of the process was, you know, you go to close a bug, you have to hit the buzzer, and you get the dun, 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 and then you have to yell bug number and name. when you're working as much as the team was working, you know, a little thing to grab onto that kind of keeps you close to sane is not a bad thing. So that was fun. To give you an idea about testing, as I said, we did system tests once a week for basically the whole year and a half, as much of it as we had a system together for. For the 45 days immediately before the race, that was what we were doing with system testing. We'd go out and we'd get more than 6 hours a day of testing on the vehicles. And then we'd come back and we'd say, what broke? File the bugs and then go fix it. And then be there until 2 a.m. and get up the next day and repeat. It was really just an exciting time because you could see all these great things, these great visions that everybody on the team had coalescing and actually becoming a vehicle that was capable and could go out and frankly surprise us with how well it worked. As part of the test process, we would write a report. There would be a report sent out every day, and they looked something like this, where we'd have a couple pictures, what went on, and then we'd have, you know, some subsystems we were testing, and we'd say whether they passed or failed. And we were brutally honest with the testing, to the point, you know, with a couple of weeks before the race, I was getting very nervous phone calls from some of our sponsors, you know. Geez, it doesn't look like it's going really well. You're reporting, 17 bugs a day. And what I had to kind of reassure people was that, well, yes, we're reporting 17 bugs a day, but these are bugs that are becoming more and more and more obscure. And they're less and less likely to occur. You know, the vehicle would go out and it would run near flawlessly. Except, you know, when somebody puts a garbage can exactly there and another garbage can exactly there and there's a car coming at and there's three cars blocking the intersection, at which point it would do something a little stupid. And, you know, the level to which we tested the vehicle and pushed it beyond kind of just the nominal operating was really shown in the race where, as you'll see in a couple of minutes, it did a couple of odd things, but it kept moving and it ended up being pretty quick. A last thing about scope of testing. We put more than 3,000 kilometers of testing on the vehicles over the year. And that doesn't count simulation time, that doesn't count data playback time, that's time on the two vehicles. This is just a quick example of a system test to let you know when we're going out there to test it, we're not testing it to succeed, we're testing to see where it fails. So this was a test devised for the parking lot planner, and this is just mean. So the idea was Boss would have to come in over here, and these parking spots are about to scale, so that's about the size of a car. So you can see it's about 2.5-3 car lengths wide and skinny and long. And then I had to wind through, you know, pop into the two spots, wind through this very tight cone field, pop into spots, pop into spots, and come out. This is much harder than anything DARPA ever gave us, much harder than we expected DARPA would give us, but it allowed us to push the system and see where it broke. So on to the race. This was by far the most amazing day I've ever witnessed in robotics. We had 11 autonomous vehicles out driving around, for the most part safely, interacting with one another, and just, you know, a lot of the time you couldn't tell whether that was a person in the car or not, you know, other than the fact that it had, you know, $500,000 worth of sensors on the roof. But other than that, you know, it was amazing. But for us, it was a race that nearly wasn't. And I don't know how many of you were in the stands or how many of you were watching on the web, but you know, we had done very well in the qualifiers. And we had earned pole position by being pretty fast. And so we got to go first. And not only did we get to go first, we got the position farthest across the grandstand so that Boss could pull out and drive in front of everybody. unfortunately, that was also where they chose to put the Jumbotron, right behind us. And it turns out the Jumbotrons, they don't do a whole lot of EMI engineering on, because I guess they put them in stadiums, and you know, who cares if your cell phone doesn't work when you stood next to it, you shouldn't be that close. So we are out on the starting line, and we have about an hour and a half boot up process to make sure everything's running ready. And we get the vehicle up, and it's all good. It's just like every other day, no problems. And we start that early, we bring it over the starting line, it's all good, we're ready to go. Yeah, we're gonna kick some butt today. And about 15 minutes before it's supposed to start, bang! Suddenly we're not getting anything on our GPS receivers. We have three different channels we should get GPS information, we're getting nothing. Well, Boss needs GPS, otherwise it's kind of screwed. It needs to know where it is to start with. So anyway, we start to look around, and you know, this can't be happening. Memories of 2005 came back pretty vividly, and then the team jumped into action, and all the testing and training and process we had in place kicked in, and we looked at you know what was going on, and we got a second unit over, second GPS, plugged that in. Okay, it still doesn't work, so it's not our hardware. We looked around and we realized that what had just happened was Tony Tether had started talking and they'd fired up the Jumbotron. And so, you know, there's all this EMI in the air, we guessed. We got them to turn off the Jumbotron, and 30 minutes later, Boss launched without incident, and the rest is history. But it was a very tense 20 minutes, half an hour. So to give you an idea of what race day looked like, this is a vehicle from Ford over on the left here. This is Boss that we're on board, obviously. This is the MIT Beast driving around out there. We're interacting with them and doing, you know, reasonable and safe things. Again, with those guys from Ford. And the chase car drivers didn't always obey the rules, as you saw there, going right through the stop line. So that Boss was able to deal with that, though. Here's an intersection that we pulled up to, and again, it's kind of boring video because you know it sits there and does what it's supposed to. That was the entry from University of Pennsylvania, probably the cutest robot on the course, little Prius. Come around the corner here, and this is representative of what most of the driving experience looked like. This was perhaps the most terrifying kind of pass you could do here, Terramax. So we had just, you know, got the system out onto the track, and you know, the adrenaline level was starting to come down because it had actually gone out. And I get a radio call. Boss is going head on with Oshkosh, which is the giant truck you saw go by. I'm like, oh, please tell me they're in different lanes. and you know, it kept going, so I guess they were. I never really found out, but it looks like it. So this is an indication that you know Boss is actually doing some smart things. It's not just kind of running around on rails with a pre-programmed script. So here we've come to an intersection. Let me just see if I can get my mouse and pause it. And there's some interesting things going on here. Okay, one, there's a robot over here, which is cool. But it's just stopped and not doing anything. And then right above that, in the wrong lane, looking at us, is another robot, which is less cool. probably shouldn't be over there. And then there's you know some traffic behind it. So this robot that's up at the front here, this was a, I don't know what team that was, UCF, I think. It's been sat there for a while. I think the video's playing again. So Boss is waiting patiently and says, oh, well, you're not going to go? Okay. And this is part of that error recovery system that we have in the vehicle where it kicks in and says, well, nothing's happening. I need to do something because if I just sit there deadlocked for the next 4 hours, that's the end of the race. And it's very much what a person would do, right? At some point you say, I'm going to go now and take action. So how did it turn out? Well, as I said earlier, it was an amazing day. 11 vehicles qualified. Of those 11 vehicles, 6 of them finished, which you know, kind of blew my personal expectation for the day by about 5. So that was pretty cool. 3 did so within the allotted time, which was also pretty impressive. You know, these are vehicles. You know, in DARPA or in the Defense Department, they talk about this concept of system of systems, right? That you have big systems and they're all made up of little systems. And on this day, we had 11 different systems out there interacting with one another and without any kind of common architect. And they did so in a way that was safe, for the most part, and was really impressive. It was it really gave me a little faith that we could do something with this whole robotics thing. Nobody was perfect, but they were all, you know, tremendous to be out there. And we finished about 20 minutes quicker than the guys from Stanford, so that was nice. So a little bit about imperfection. So this is the display of us driving past IVST, which was that Ford team. That was the first little bit of video I showed in the previous frame. And those of you who were really careful might have noticed they were partway across the center line. And they were. And so here's our GUI, and we're showing them slightly across the center line, which is they're kind of this blur right here. Apologize for the Windows Media encoding here. And then Boss is over here on the right, and Boss is saying that this car has got just enough room that it can get by, and that was true. And then what happened here is this was the first little bit of excitement we had in the day. So this is the chase car, that blue rectangle up there that we detected, and it had just transitioned from being a point obstacle to a moving vehicle. And then for a moment there, we thought it was going to come into our lane. And so Boss says, "Whoa, that's bad news," and swerves to try and avoid it, and then gets very, very close to the K-rail over here, which, you know, K-rail is the big Jersey barrier stuff along the side of the road. And this is where I got a frantic radio call. Boss has stopped and it's not moving. And the first part was that it was paused, which actually probably did us more harm than good here. They basically paused the whole course because two other vehicles had a near collision. When Boss recovered from this, it sat there for a while and it couldn't figure out how to get forward because basically there's a wall right in front of it and a wall very close to behind it, and it couldn't move. Fortunately, the behavioral system kicked in and tried to jimmy it around enough, and in practice, that really didn't do anything directly, but what it did do is it moved the vehicle around enough that the state estimation slipped a little bit. We thought we were far enough from the wall, and then we could move. So, you know, it's part of designing a reliable system is that it kind of gets lucky some of the time because you designed it to do things that make luck favor it. Some other imperfections. We said that it's a 60-mile race. It would actually turn out that we drove 54 miles on race day. And I'll pause this for a moment. What we found is that the race was really 52.8 miles. So if you just run the race as DARPA asked you and you run the simulation so you don't do any kind of extra weaving, it was 52.8 miles. So that means we drove about an extra mile and a half, and I'll show you why in a moment here. Something that's interesting is the average speed for our vehicle over the whole race was 14 miles per hour, which doesn't sound that fast, but it was bounded by speed limits from DARPA and other traffic. In simulation, the fastest we could go is 15.2 miles per hour. So we were actually doing pretty darn well, because the simulation doesn't include any traffic. We cost ourselves 9 minutes by going this extra 2 miles, if you consider we moved at the average speed for that. So what happened? So this is a little animation. Boss is tracking up to this intersection. It sees that car in front of it. It waits for that car. And then it waits for that car. And then it waits for that car. Now it's waiting for some other car coming across here. At this point, Boss should have rolled up to the stop line because that car is not in on our side of the road. And to be honest with you, we don't actually know what happened here yet. We're still looking into it. But at some point, this was the behavioral system counting down, basically saying you're not making progress. Something's odd. And then at some point in just a moment here, it's going to say, okay, I'm not going this way. Let's make a U-turn. We'll head back that way. And it took some other route to get where it was going. Backs up and says, in a moment here, it's going to wait because it sees a car coming in off screen here, and it realizes that to make this U-turn takes a significant amount of time. That car doesn't have to stop, so we better yield to him before doing something unsafe and pulling out in front of them. And then in a moment here, it'll pull the U-turn and go off and do an extra mile and a half or 2 miles, whatever it was. So that's interesting. That's kind of one of the open questions from the day is what the heck happened here, and we'll look at the data and figure that out. If I can get to the next slide. But the moral of the story is that kind of all's well that ends well. We ended up coming back and getting across the finish line. We've pulled across the finish line in about 45 seconds behind the guys from Stanford. There's a really great video. I don't have it here. The Stanford guys excited. And, you know, their vehicles just won the race. It's come in first. And then Darby says, hurry up and get out there. And we have video of our robot pulling in as their guys running into their robot to get off the road because Boss is coming in right behind them to steal the stage. So that was pretty exciting. So some lessons learned. One of the things that we noticed during the course of this is that driving is really a social activity. There's a lot of very subtle cues that are passed between people in different vehicles. I make eye contact with somebody and you know indicate to them that they can cut in front of me. I might leave a slightly larger gap. I might gesture that I was displeased with their action or to let them come in. And obviously our robot was incapable of doing any of that. And I think that in the long term, to mix these things with other vehicles, we need to inject some of this social interaction. Next is that, you know, I probably don't need to tell everybody here this, but perception is still hard. It's not a solved problem, and particularly doing it in real time. I showed a couple of the foibles that were primarily due to sensor glitches or perceptive glitches. There really isn't a right sensor. The reason why we had to put, 19, 27 sensors on our vehicle is because there just isn't a sensor out there that does what we need it to do. So we have to fuse all this different data, and, you know, by getting better sensors, we could reduce that complexity. One of the things that this video is showing is this is Boss driving along a road during one of the qualifier tests, and it kind of demonstrates some of the clunkiness in our representation. So we basically had two different layers of representation. One is the very geometric, this is where the cars are, this is where the obstacles, and another was more symbolic about this is the car on the road, and this is how far in front down the road that car is. And that triggered different behavioral modes and kind of that symbolic layer. But it also had to interact at the low level with the motion planning. And so there was cases where along the side of the road here, it didn't make the correct decision about whether it had room to pass a car or not because that geometric and symbolic layers were kind of muddled. You saw for a while, sometimes it would creep out around cars, sometimes it would just kind of blow past them as if they weren't there. And so we need to come up with a better representation that captures those two aspects of what's going on. And then the last is that I really believe that safe autonomous travel is near. You know, we actually can get there. It's not, you know, it's no longer this, you know, mystic thing that should only be in sci-fi movies. I actually think within, you know, a decade we could actually get this technology to the point where you could deploy it and, you know, put on your makeup as you're driving to work in the morning or read the newspaper or, you know, sleep. So, in summary, Boss is pretty amazing vehicle. We really had a lot of fun building it, and I think we learned a lot of things out of that process. We really had a great team, and as I said a couple of times today, I'm just the person giving the talk today. There's a lot of brilliant people in the room that worked on this project, and I'd encourage you to seek them out. They were a great bunch to work with. And finally, boy, does it feel much better to win than come second. You know, we had an incredibly capable vehicle the previous race, and, you know, the Sanford guys did as well. We had a little bit of bad luck, and, you know, it just was disappointing this time. You know, it worked out pretty well for us. So that's my talk. I thank you all for coming at this kind of odd time of day. Apologize, I need to be in a different country tomorrow. So this was the only kind of day that worked between now and the holidays. So thank you all for being here. Appreciate it. Yeah, absolutely. John.
I remember talking to you some time ago. You were having a lot of frustration that GM would not be able to talk to the engine.
Jim would what, sorry?
The code to talk to the engine.
Yes.
You put a mechanical actuator on the gas pedal, which converted to code, which then.
Yes.
Did you ever get that?
Yeah, for the gas we did, and you know we ended up working with GM, and it worked out well. It's just, you know, these are very secure parts of the vehicle. If anyone could just kind of like plug a computer into my car and jam the gas home, that would probably be bad. So it ended up having to work through a bit of bureaucracy to get access to that, but it ended up working out. Reed?
So 20 minutes, you know, picking up 20 minutes over a 4-hour race is a lot. Do you have some idea of
why?
What the difference was? Did they just go slower? Did they take many more detours than you did?
So there are a few things. So one is we gave them back 9 minutes by pulling a U-turn. So we really we're going 30 minutes faster. We built Boss to be a race car from the start. And that means that it gets on the gas as hard as it can to get up to speed. and it gets on the brake as late as possible to get down from speed. And that means that it's maintaining top speed for as long as possible. And we think that was an advantage. We think that was a big advantage. We know that Stanford this year was not as prepared as we were. And they were hacking code till 4 in the morning the night before the race. And one of the things that we saw was that Junior would go out, and there was a traffic circle right near the entry, and the vehicles came by through there 11 times that day, or 10 times. And every time Junior would come out, it would actually do an extra lap over there. So it was a little bit of showboating by the Stanford guys, I guess. And so that certainly cost them some time. They certainly didn't accelerate like we did, and they didn't brake like we did. I don't know enough about what happened out in the course to give you any more insight than that. We could see less than the guys watching the video could. So I'll talk to Mike this weekend and see if he's got any insights. Okay.
Christian, do you analyze any of the data after from the race day to figure out, in particular I'm interested in, if you looked at how good your pose was, how much you were relying on pose, or just how much you were relying on lane traffic?
We haven't looked at that. I can tell you that the vehicle came into the start area with a 1.9 meter error in GPS. 1.9 meters would have put it through a wall. So we were definitely using the lane localization. That's actually a pretty good story as well. So there was a point in the race. Basically, the race was broken into three missions. And they went out and did one, came back, and we launched it again. After the second mission, this is when it came back with this large pose error. We came in basically moments before Stanford, so there was all, yeah. We're going to get one of those vehicles out in front of the other. And so we open up the hatch, and 1.9 meter GPS error, crap, that's bad. So we ended up making the tactical decision of, we will sit and use our whole 5 minutes here, and we will wait, because we were given 5 minutes to relaunch the vehicle without penalty. So we will wait and hope that get the Stanford guys out first, because they're all geared up to go. And then we'll get some extra waiting, because they wait for that vehicle to clear. So we ended up sitting there and getting our pose estimation narrowed down to 40 centimeters or 30 centimeters or something. So, Kita.
You've highlighted some of the good points of your software development process, modularity, visualization, bug
yep.
tracking. Are there things that you feel continue to be a problem, or things that you do differently next time?
Well, I'll give you the generic answer first. Multi-threaded stuff is still a disaster to debug, you know, in the software world. That's just hard. People know that, but we had a couple places where we had to do that to get things to interact. And you can, you know, there's a lot of process you can put around other things that just hard. What would we do differently next time? Well, one is we would save a lot of time by using this infrastructure, because we put a lot of person time into that, so that would be a big thing. We did not get to the point of doing event-driven signaling inside the processes, and that actually led to some inefficiencies in places. So everything we have in our system is polled right now, so that's something we'd add. On a software kind of development process front, I think we would work harder to reinforce the schedule sooner. So this is kind of a management thing, but we had a schedule laid out, and it was aggressive because the whole process was aggressive, the whole research agenda. But we kind of fell off the wagon pretty early, and then, you know, hustled to get caught up, and then fell off the wagon, and then, you know. So I think if we could we could address that scheduling and try and, I don't know how you get people excited about schedule, but you know, we could do that better, that's for sure. And I haven't had a whole lot of time to think about the rest. Brian Selescu is our software lead. He might have some good ideas about how to make software better.
I think managing the scope creep towards the end. So Chris talked about how we would come back with 17 new bugs, you know, a week before the race, and those bugs got more and more exotic, to the point where any one bug, someone would spend 15 minutes on a whiteboard just trying to explain all the things that had to come together to make that problem, like,
go away.
Manifest itself. And there comes a point where you just have to say, it is what it is, stop. And I think we did that. I think we made the call to start ignoring some of those problems too late in the program. So that gets to your skill.
Yeah. I think we gave Brian
that. It takes you 20 minutes to explain to me how five vehicles had to interact in just the right way at this, you know,
four-way intersection or whatever, it's just, sometimes you just gotta call it quits.
Okay. Carl?
You just talked about how great some of the cool infrastructure stuff that you work on and how much you'd like to and use it the next time you get something like this. So is this going to be something that others of us can use and you have plans?
That's, so we need to clean it up a little bit, but yeah, we'd really like to get this out to other people. So I kind of did a hatchet job explaining it up here, but it consists of a new IPC system that we're pretty psyched about how much data we can push through that. We're pushing with the Velodyne, it's 1 million dots per second. You know, all the other sensors, we generate a half terabyte of data in 6 hours, and that's not including camera data. So we're pushing all that system multiple times through the comms layer, so there's an awful lot of data going through it. So we're pretty happy with that efficiency we got there. All the rest of the task infrastructure and data display stuff, yeah, we'd like to get out and broadly disseminated, but we'd like to clean it up before handing it off to people so that it's not kind of stillborn.
It needs to be documented.
Yeah. Come on, we documented everything, Brian. I don't understand. Russ? It's going to sound bad, but not a whole lot. We were pretty happy with what we came together with. We did have to make some adaptations on site based on what DARPA did. So, you know, this along here, and basically everywhere else on the site was K-Rail, and it was right up against the lane. And it turns out that it's really good for generating radar returns. So you see this little hole here? That's just a near-perfect radar reflector, this angle, and you get there's some other artifacts along the side of these things that do that. So we had to make some minor adaptations to what DARPA put out there, but I think overall, and please other people on the team jump in, but overall I think we were pretty happy with what we came up with and thought that, you know, as it showed, it was the pretty much the most capable vehicle out there. One thing that we could do differently that we had started to do but didn't finish was localizing based on geometric features as well. So we used lane markings to localize. The guys from Stanford, and we also started to look at curb markings. The guys from Stanford used lane markings and curbs to localize, and that buys them some advantages in places where you can't see the lane markings. So that's something we would add in.
So you talked about sort of these things being available near term. I don't see your average 67-year-old driver being able to afford this vehicle. So what can you cut? What's there for redundancy and what's necessary?
So there are, let me see if I can pull this up. Give me one moment here. Let me throw this sensor slide up so I can remember what I'm talking about here. So this is the suite we had. So we didn't end up using the cameras and we didn't end up using these radars. Right now, the problem is that there isn't a sensor that you can use. So we had to adapt the sensors we did have on the vehicle. So these ACC radars are amazing. But they've got a 17-degree field of view, or a 60-degree at 60 meters. But they're very narrow field of view. In urban driving, you need to see 360 degrees around the vehicle. So to use them, we had to mount them up here on these pan heads so that we could basically point them down crossroads to see where other traffic was as we came up to it. The problem is still, if you put them in Pittsburgh, they only have a 3-degree vertical field of view, which means, you know, if I'm going up Murray Hill, I can't. Up to Murray Hill, Squirrel Hill. It just won't see anything. What we need to get is some long-range, wide field of view sensors, and then we can start to cut things. And what's happened is market pressure has driven the sensor manufacturers to this ACC application, because that's where the car manufacturers are going next. As we kind of turn the attention to urban driving, then what I expect is that, you know, sensors that these sensor manufacturers are going to get the the idea from the manufacturers, the auto manufacturers, to go to these places, and things like flash LiDAR might actually become practical, and you know that could conceivably be relatively inexpensive and durable, and all these other good things.
I remember from the Driver Grand Challenges, there was a trailer full of people actually fine-tuning the path after we canned it off.
Yep.
Was this did the same thing have to happen for this, or was it?
So we had a much smaller trailer full. We had two people or three people that went through and took the path and looked at aerial imagery and aligned the road shapes with that aerial imagery. I believe that you don't need the army of undergraduates or even the three people in the trailer. I believe that when this will go commercial, what will happen is the first time you drive the car somewhere, either you'll be a late adopter and it'll just talk to the mothership and get the map from, you know, GM.com, or the first time you drive it somewhere, if you live out in the boonies, it'll record these maps and then it'll be able to localize from them over time. You know, so you drive for 2 or 3 days, it does something, you know, with that statistically significant and gives you a roadmap that it can use. And I think that's actually a really interesting area of research to push forward in. Carl.
So I watched most of the race on the web, and I had was amazed kind of by the same thing you said, that after a while it actually got a little boring.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, it really was.
So one of the really exciting times was there was this actual accident between these two, and it seemed like a pretty interesting case where, you know, the one in the front was stopped for a little while, and then the one behind, you know, did kind of a procedure similar to what you described, where you said, okay, this thing stopped, I'm going to treat it as a static obstacle now and not worry about it. Went around to pass, and its passing maneuver would have succeeded, except that at the last second,
this is the video Carl's talking about, I think. Oh, this is the one that screwed up. I'm sorry, you could hear people talking about them crashing. So I guess this vehicle crashes into that vehicle, or vice versa.
So I guess the question to you then is, it seemed right that if the front vehicle had stayed still, the one would have made the turn okay. Like it had a proper pre-plan, but then things changed the last second.
Yeah.
After it was almost, you know, passing it. So the sensor configuration and other things going on in your vehicle, like if you guys had been the one behind, you know, would maybe walk through the steps of what
right.
you expect would have happened.
So. So the only thing I take issue with is that it made a proper passing maneuver. So, you know, this is a, you know, on a road, right? If you, when it cut back in, it cut back in within a meter of the vehicle in front of it. And so that leaves very little room for error. In our case, our vehicle would have pulled out and left, you know, a vehicle length or more between it. And so it would have been a little more cautious in re-entering the lane. And it's unlikely that we would have had a collision. So, you know, we have a sensor configuration that would have allowed us to track it pretty well. But the big thing is that, you know, the reasoning that was going on would have left a little more room and been safer.
Reed. That actually brings a question that I was thinking of asking. So you had a video where the vehicle was stopped, the facing vehicle was stopped in the intersection.
Yeah.
Waited, decided to go into the intersection.
Yep.
Now you enter the intersection. What would you have done if it started?
Avoided it. So we do prediction on that vehicle or stopped for it, whatever, so that the local planning that's going down in lanes or moving us through the intersection is actually considering collisions and prediction. So as that vehicle starts to move, we predict kind of the future of that vehicle, and we'll say, so I think I have a video just to show this, show that I'm not just making this stuff up. Which I could be doing here. But that's not it. Maybe I could dig around it after and I can show you. But basically, we did testing where we pushed an inflatable car out of the intersection. You know, we hit it some of the time, but not regularly. You know, by the end of the program, we weren't hitting it. But yeah, it's a real problem.
That's really an interesting question. So, you guys did testing with inflatable cars, and obviously there were other drivers on. Car is a fairly safe thing. You really have to smack a
yep.
car pretty hard and hurt. How do you do testing biped?
Oh, geez, yeah, we didn't. We, you know, it was out of scope. How do you do it for real?
Yeah.
I haven't put a whole lot of thought into that yet. I think you can do
undergrads.
I think the undergrad army is perhaps the best solution. I think you could do some simulants. I think you could put, basically a store dummy, on wheels, and push that out there. I'm not volunteering to do it.
So maybe I missed this, but for the stop signs and arrangement of two-way stop pre-programmed into the map that Barbara gave you?
Yeah, they gave us so they had said up front that there wouldn't necessarily be a stop sign where we want you to stop, and so they gave us GPS coordinates of the stop lines.
Did you have to deal with non-orthogonal intersections?
Yes. I don't know if any came up in the race, but we tested against many non-orthogonal intersections.
But you can know it ahead of time that was non-orthogonal.
Yeah. Yeah. We were given that map, and the underlying assumption here is that you build a city, the roads are going to stay there, or they're going to change with a sufficiently low frequency that you can get that information.
So you had logic in place to point the sensors.
Yeah. As it would come up to the intersection, it would look at that geometry and say, okay, I need to point this sensor back at 115 degrees instead of 45 degrees forward or wherever it rests normally.
You mentioned Pittsburgh, we have these hills.
Yeah.
And we also have potholes construction. So in the test, it seemed very flat and very structured. Is Boss capable of dealing with hills?
It's always a matter of degree, but yes. So we, the site we had at Robot City was actually pretty good that way. What you really, you don't really care about the size of the hill, you care about the rate of change of slope. Because, once you're on that plane, it's a plane. So your 3-degree vertical beam width is good. It's as you're transitioning from this plane to that plane that's an issue. And what we found was, that we had this test site that we thought was very benign. It looked pretty flat, it was a little bumpy, it had potholes, but it had enough of a slope that just using the basic ACC sensors, we couldn't navigate it safely. And we think that gave us a huge advantage because we were forced to deal with these issues of slope and elevation change and actually make the vehicle work on them. And I think Mike will go bald prematurely because of the testing that we did here and how much trouble it caused our perception system.
What about the potholes, the sort of negative obstacles that are not necessarily in your map?
Right. So we said it's a Chevy Tahoe. If it can't drive over enough, whatever number of potholes it's going to encounter in a 60-mile race, then we've got bigger problems. But significant negative obstacles like ditches, everyone who's worked in perception understands that that's a geometric issue and. Right now, there's not a good way to address it.
Yeah. You're very aggressively accelerating and braking.
Yep.
Sometimes in these videos, you can see the picture pitching.
Yep.
I guess that would tie into this issue of whether your sensors are pointed ahead or not.
Right.
Didn't you have problems losing your field of view?
That was mostly an engineering issue. So we found kind of the sweet spot for the sensor pointing. We also built hysteresis into our system so that, the amount of time that it dips down and comes back up, that it's outside of that field of view range is pretty small. And so by having some hysteresis in the system, we could keep that around. You got anything more you'd add to it, Mike? Okay. Reed?
So now you've got this great software infrastructure. What's
yep.
next?
What's next? Well, there's a few things. So we're working with a couple of our sponsors, Caterpillar and General Motors in particular, to take this and push it to the next level, actually make it work well enough that they could put it into products. I can't really say much about either right now, but those are the two big things. I think some interesting problems from the kind of non-application point of view are what I said to Mike over here about the map building. I think distributed map building is gonna be the way of it. So right now, Google goes around and they have, a dozen or 100 or 300 or 1,000, however many cars they have, taking pictures and doing road surveys and all this. If instead you put simple sensing on every 2009 model Chevy vehicle, the quality and update rate of the maps you're going to get are going to be so much higher. You know, you have basically instantly 10% market penetration, and the number of vehicles in America is ridiculous. So, you know, you could, with very simple sensors on these vehicles, you could build up these incredible maps of the country, and then you can use that to shoehorn in autonomy after that, which I think would be really interesting. I think some of the other parts of the system that would be really fun to look at are this social interaction of how do you, you know, Boss is a bit of a jerk. It's both a ninny and a jerk. You know, at an intersection, it's, you know, kind of sit there and wait, and then go. And then when it's driving, it'll get, you know, it actually holds a pretty good distance, but it guns it and gets up to that distance and then waits there and slams on the brake, and it's a little exciting. So I you know, that's clearly not socially acceptable. So I think looking at how to make the vehicle more natural and interact with human traffic would be pretty cool. And I think it's actually an easier problem than interacting with robotic traffic, because for the most part, you see Boss coming at the road, you're going to give it a little room, you know, and you're going to make a hole for it if it starts to move over. And, you know, people do kind of natural things with idiot drivers.
Last question.
So if there had been 11 bosses on the course that day, was that a hint of that social interaction? Like, if all of them were self-aware or all aware of each other, would that have made this a completely different experience?
Oh, certainly it would have been. Wow.
My point is, if there was a unified way for all of those cars to have been speaking to each other.
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of interesting work that's been going on in vehicle to vehicle and vehicle to infrastructure communication, and what you can buy from that in terms of you know, car spacing and rerouting. And yeah, there's a lot of things you could have done if the vehicles could have communicated to one another. We haven't yet put a whole lot of thought into that, but you know, if we end up pursuing this further. It's certainly going to be a part of it. Hopefully it would be an open standard.
All right, let's thank our speaker.
Thank you. Oh, thanks, Kita.
Good seeing you.
Yeah, oh, really?